Next up, number 687, August 2021.
Hi there, this is Susie from In His Shoes Ministries. Thanks for tuning into the Next Step with Father Vodskin. We are the voice of Armadoxy, a weekly podcast started in 2008 that looks at life through the lens of Armenian Orthodoxy. We reach out to those who are searching for practical and deeper applications of faith, the disenfranchised members of the church community, and the neophyte, those who are discovering truths in ancient Orthodoxy. If you're joining us for the first time, we're so glad you're here. And if you're a regular listener, welcome back. Now, let's get ready to take the next step.
Good to have you with us. I'm glad you're joining us today. We've got a great hour for you today. So sit back and relax. Not too relaxed if you're driving, okay? It is a time where you can take off your mask. If you are by yourself, if you are in the proximity of others, please keep that mask on. And by all means, make sure you are vaccinated. Very important. I don't know what people are fighting. Go get the vaccine if you haven't gotten the vaccine yet. And, you know, ordinarily, I would tell you, take me along. You know, put me in your earbuds and take me along. It's a good way of passing the time as you're waiting in line and you're getting ready and you get vaccinated and you wait. But today I'm going to tell you, don't take me along, because I've got an extra meaty podcast. I want you to pay some attention, okay? So don't clutter it up with other things. Just sit back and kick back. We've got a great interview for you today with a young lady named Ani Shahinyan, a scholar, comes to us from Oxford, and I'll share with you in just a couple moments about her. But what I want to start off with is something. There was like two bits of email that came to me yesterday. One was somebody had went on a rant about, you know, all the ails of the world and gave me his philosophy on how to deal with it vis-a-vis the political realm. And I won't even get into what the kind of things. Yes, yes, I do bring these kind of people on to me, right? Well, that's what happens. You're on the internet and you've got these shows. People will respond to you. That's fine, okay? But the other email was very, very serious. It was from a listener who wanted to share Pope Francis's message. And I was very moved by what the pontiff had to say, what the pontiff had to share. And it just resonated with me. And as we were putting together today's show, it reminded me that, you know, we as an Armenian church are so ahead of the game. It's just that we're so tiny, you know, it's like nobody knows, nobody cares. It's like when you go to Armenia, you know, have you ever been into any of those ancient ruins, or you go into one of these ancient churches and you're just, your jaw drops and you're just looking around and you're going, where is Discovery Channel? How come National Geographic's not out here? Well, it's a small little place. There's other people that they're focusing in on. Yeah, I know, here and there some people will focus in. But anyway, that's another discussion. But what the Pope had to say, I think it's so important that we address and we talk about it, because it does signal a change, a remarkable change. And I think, as I said a few minutes ago, yes, it's a change that we've been talking about here at the Next Step. It's part of what we believe is Armadoxy, Armenian Orthodoxy without the hoopla, right? Armadoxy. Anyway, we will get to that for sure next week, and definitely those of you who will be part of the Questions of Faith group this coming Monday night, we will be looking at that as well. For today, I am very excited because a couple weeks ago we sat down with Ani Shahinyan, a brilliant scholar, an articulate voice for the Armenian Church. I've had the pleasure of knowing her for, I'd say, at least a decade, if not more. We've corresponded via email, and we caught up together in Los Angeles at the St. Leon Armenian Cathedral in Burbank, Sarpolz-Revontians. And we recorded a conversation that I'd like to share with you. I wanted to share with you, our Next Step listeners, this voice, this person, and what she has to offer all of us by way of what the Armenian Church possesses. In other words, Yes, we are small, but man, look at what we've produced. Anyway, I won't say more. I'll let her say it. Here is a conversation with Anisha Hegel. Well, we are at the St. Leon Armenian Cathedral in beautiful Burbank, California, and I'm sitting across Ani Shahinyan. She is a doctoral candidate in history and theology at the University of Oxford. She holds an MA degree in Near Eastern and Languages and Culture, Armenian History and Literature from UCLA, and is a graduate and has graduate certificates in philosophy and theology from the University of Oxford. It doesn't get any better. And I am honored that you took some time today to be with us and to share some ideas, because we've had a chance to speak. For years, we've had chances to communicate via email, and I'm really happy that we have this opportunity. So welcome.
Thank you, Father Moskin.
And we're in the main cathedral, so we have the echo in the background. We have some beautiful shuragans going. And I want to start off with you. Who are you? Can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself? What brought you to the interest in Armenian religious studies? I mean, it's pretty wild.
I should start off to say that when my family first moved to the U.S. from Armenia, I was very young. And I soon learned to sort of distance myself from the Armenian tradition. The fact that I've made a full circle back to the Armenian tradition says something in and of itself. Mm-hmm. You know, I was very passionate from a very young age about truth and sort of what it means to defend the voiceless and speak the truth confidently. These were the things that were sort of my values, I would say. It was probably my parents' values. It's how probably it transferred into my own thinking. It wasn't until I was in Washington years after that I learned to answer some of the questions that were had been elongated in my entire sort of past since I was a child. Was to return from there, from where I actually came from. Mm-hmm. And that was to find sort of the answers in both in my own family background, but also broader than that. So who were the Armenians? Everything I've been told by my parents, is it true? Does it have a base in reality? Or is this some sort of, you know, things that I have heard about my ancestors? And it's that inspiration really that sort of brings me back to understand my tradition and my culture in a more informed way, not just something that someone has said to me, but something that, you know, I can say, you know, I've actually checked this out and it makes sense, and let me share why.
And so you found some answers within the Armenian Church for these questions. Yeah, these life questions, basically, that everybody goes through in search for their own identity.
I did, yes. And it wasn't just because it's Armenian. I think it was because, first and foremost, for me, it was the fact that there was a continuity within its Christian tradition. And that, to me, was important. Why? You know, I've lived in various parts of the world. I've been in various cultures and in professionally and academically in different circles. And I had to believe in something that wasn't just propositionally true. That is to say, you know, something that, okay, you know, it seems like I have the right words for it. But it had to sort of resonate with the person and the experience. And it had to be true, not only in my case, but that's been true in period of past. So, for example, going to the church fathers, what did they say? And does that make sense in the time that period, you know, 1,000 years after? And does it make sense today? Mm-hmm. And if it does make sense, then maybe there is something there. And that's what I call principles.
If it doesn't make sense.
If it doesn't make sense, then I want to ask the question of, well, perhaps this is something specific to the culture, as opposed to specific in that time period that made sense then. Because I've come to understand that it's the fullness of what it means to be human through which we are. Sort of, you know, have our various angles and, you know, of understanding. So if something in that period doesn't make sense, then perhaps I need to contextualize it a bit more to understand what it meant for the people who actually said and wrote and believed those things, as opposed to dismiss it. You know, so it's easy to dismiss something just because we don't understand it. But if I contextualize it, does it say something more?
And so you, when you say, you know, you found these answers within the Armenian Church, and you make a point of saying, if I got it right, the Christian traditions that are in. Mm-hmm. So the Armenian Church, as you know, has been criticized, particularly in the last 100, 200 years, for its lack of connection to Christianity. But I assume that if you found that Christian root, that you see that connection.
Absolutely. And I think it's a bit disheartening to say that certain events in history have sort of caused pause or some sort of, you know, trouble in sort of that continuation. So, for example, whether it's the genocide or the Sovietization of Armenia, these are periods we first need to sort of understand in their context. So when we say the church has sort of found some sort of discontinuity, if I may use that word, in the last 100 years, the question is why and what's the context of that. For example, I ended up deciding to do my doctoral thesis in the 14th, 15th century, because there was a period there that I felt I could actually learn something about my faith that still makes sense today. And that is because this period still keeps true to its sort of, I would say, tradition, yet there are people who interpret it in that context, which hasn't really come down to us, I would say, even in the last 100 years, if I may. I mean, perhaps early 20th century, we still have people who are explaining these tenets and these truths to us. But perhaps if someone says that in the last 100 years there's been this challenge, I think it's very important to look at the context, and I think it's true. And in I think the Sovietization and that's come into our sort of tradition has harmed quite a bit. And right now we're in a very good place to recover from that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's sort of my inspiration as well, because my background goes into both Eastern and Western Armenia. So on my father's side, I'm impacted by the genocide, and my mother's side, I'm impacted by the Sovietization.
I see.
So both are always permanently sort of parallel in my mind as to how I understand both scripture, but also my culture, but also the tradition, and how that makes sense to me today.
Can you explain a little bit more what you meant, like right now we are in a good place?
We are in an excellent place. Why? Because I would say multiple things. So two things just to focus on. First and foremost, the freedoms that we have today to sort of think and articulate. I think this is something that, especially for someone like me to be able to do that, I think that's a very important factor to, you know, understand and, you know, identify. But also, I mean, looking back, we're in a period where you can look back as far as possible. Mm-hmm. We're in a period where we have access to so many materials. So, for example, today I have access to probably more materials than anyone would have had even 20, 30 years ago. This is, of course, due to technology. This is due to the modernization of our world. And I think it's very important to take advantage of that. Mm-hmm. And I take that lesson from someone like, the Vartapets, the teachers of our church, the Armenian church of the 14th, 15th century. When there is a progress of some sort in how they can actually experience and exercise their faiths, they take advantage of that. Mm-hmm. And I would say that's exactly where we are today. We are in a place where there are a handful of things that we can take advantage of to really be able to bring forth or bring together some of the richness that we have in our history today than we had, I would say, even probably a couple decades ago. I think also people's minds, a third thing probably, is because we're a little bit more open today than we were a few decades ago. We're in a place where we can make sense of things, and we just really need to, there are a handful of people who have spent a lot of time. And I think you also, I mean, I've read so many of your works from the 90s and 80s that you've invested so much in what it means to bring the fullness of our humanity, but also our fate together, that today I think people are a little bit more open to.
Well, let's dive into some of these. You mentioned the Vartabeds. Now, who are these people? What do they mean to you? And how is somebody from the, what's he saying in the 14th century mm-hmm. that makes sense to me out today?
So for my doctoral thesis, mm-hmm. I came to know Grigor Zenon Skhalatidze, born between the years of 1350, he was sometime born in 1350, was martyred in 1425. He is the compiler of the Heismavurk, as we have it, I think he's the last compiler of the Heismavurk. So what we would have been reading along with our liturgical services up until about the late 1800s, which today is still being read in Jerusalem, mm-hmm. he's the compiler of that. He's the last compiler of that. So He has the full force of the Armenian sort of Christian tradition and scripture, and is being able to sort of bring all of that together in his time period. This is one. Mateus Jurayetsi, who is a relative of Khalatetsi, born again sometime in the late 1349, 1350, and is passes away sometime in 1411. These dates are not precise. They're in scholarship. It's not sort of set in stone. But we believe he must have passed away sometime in 1411 based on his last manuscript. And he's, you know, I learned these two individuals alone have taught me more than I can ever want in my life. Because I'm, again, a very sort of an intellectually curious person. I like to ask questions and see whether the question can find an answer that has a sort of a logical consistency and coherence. These are important for me. My background's philosophy. So when I read Khalatetsi and I read Mateos, I find a sort of consistency and coherence that the question rises, why are we not doing today this very thing in our teachings? So these are two Vartabeds. Of course, the both of Vartabeds have their sort of training and sort of inspiration in the works of Vorodnetsi, Hovnan Vorodnetsi, who was the teacher of the many Vartabeds that I study for this period. So, for example, Tatevatsi. Many people know Grigor Tatevatsi. Again, born sometime in the early 30s, probably 40, passed away in 1409. He is also a student of Vorodnetsi. So Vorodnetsi, Hovnan Vorodnetsi, is a scholar, a philosopher, a Vartabed. I mean, so many things I can say about him that we today must recover from the ancient pages of history and bring it to the modern mind. Why do I say that? Because these Vartabeds answered some of the questions I was asking all throughout my both teens and also in my 20s, until about, I would say it was at the end of my 20s, when I, at the turn of my 30s, I saw what I'd been looking for in these texts. Mm-hmm. And the commitment then was, would I actually patiently, with all the virtues that's required for studies, sit through and actually interpret and understand and translate these texts? And that's what I've been doing the last 7 years.
So, you know, I always think that a lot of what, education or thought develop as a reaction. Mm. What was about the 14th century that you got Vorodnetsi, that you got Tatevatsi, and this, what was going on there? What brought that about?
I would say, excellent question, in the sense that in terms of bringing the relevance of all of this, it was as tumultuous and as problematic period as we are in today, in terms of whether we look at it for Armenia or the U.S. I mean, it's important for me to look at both contexts, because as an Armenian, I'm always sort of thinking about what it means, what these texts can tell me about what's happening in Armenia, but also in our global world, our international world that we live in. You know, this was a period when I would say, if I may quickly reference the 1335 fall of the Ilkhanates. This was after the Mongols. They took over Constantinople, and they took over Tabriz and Baghdad, and they had quite a bit of a roughly about 100-year rule, where halfway through they accepted Islam. Mm-hmm. And shortly after, I would say about 45, 50 years after that, the empire came to a demise. But in that period, the Armenians experienced quite a bit of a, really talking about reaction and a setback in terms of their sort of context, social, economic, political. And it's really this period is that produces or brings forth these Vartabits. This is a very sort of a tumultuous and sort of a vacuum that's created in this political context. So the church in this time period responds to it continuing doing what they're doing. That is, you know, they sort of flourish in their monasteries. What's very interesting that I'm observing is that these monasteries do not, they did not remain enclosed behind sort of monastic doors. They actually end up becoming more engaging with the community. Mm-hmm. So this is something important. I think this hasn't been studied or written about at all. And in this very difficult time where we don't, I mean, Armenia at this time doesn't have any sort of political rule. They don't have a social economic sort of structures, infrastructures. It's a very, very hard period for the people in Greater Armenia, and Cilicia falls in 1375. And the memory of the Seljuk invasion still is quite, I think, prevalent in this time. So all of these periods comes together in this sort of political social context that brings about the lives and the productions of these Vartabits. So they're living in a period where they're also very well aware of their context, about who they are living with and next to. So there is an emerging Muslim community that comes about in this time that's different than theirs. So how do you live with the other? How do you sort of... how do you sort of defend your Christian faith, or how do you live your Christian faith in this context? So the Vartabits are essentially doing that very thing for that society, for that community at that time. And I think one of my sort of hopes would be to sort of extrapolate all of those principles.
Yeah.
Because we don't, well, who's the Vartabits of our time? And who can actually do what these men...
How can
we do that? They spent, you know, a very rigorous spiritual life in, you know, prayer and meditation and contemplation and writing to bring forth these richness.
And we should explain that Vartabit was a unique rank within the church, not today where it's given as a reward to celibacy. In those times it was given as a proclamation of the man's education, of his background. It was an educational rank.
It was. And a direct translation perhaps would be to say a doctor of the church.
Doctor.
So, for example, Grigor Zerenz Khalatetsi obtains his rank as a Vartabit after he had already been reading, writing, and interpreting and commentating on scripture and sort of studying the context and the culture and all of that. I mean, his Haysma work is compiled in 1401. He obtained his rank only a few years before that. So it took, I would say, about 20 years of his training to come about to bring sort of that, to be that doctor of the church. You know, so today we probably understand the doctor of a certain field to have obtained a PhD or, a doctorate of philosophy. It's very interesting to see how they go through this process. They obtain and practice it before they're actually given that reward. Mm. Given that status. They don't have that status beforehand just because they have sort of produced some sort of work. No, it's the experience. Mm-hmm. So we look at Khalatetsi and Datevatsi especially. There is, I would say a few decades of production before they obtain that rank. Mm-hmm. And there's the students of Vorodnitsi, who himself, and all of this comes together in that sort of school of Nishetsi. Yesai Nishetsi's school is very important in our Armenian history to sort of learn and understand how it...
I just thought of it. It's important also to remember that it was an educational certificate, in a sense, that you could not give. Like a bishop who was not a Vartabit before he became a bishop, mm-hmm. could not give that Vartabit, the rank of Vartabit, to somebody.
Right,
else.
Right.
He had to be a Vartabit.
That's right.
To pass it along to another Vartabit.
Yes.
And
that's essentially what we see happening with, with Khalatetsi. He receives it from a Vartabit Sarkis mm-hmm. in Aprakunets Vank in Lake Van. So this is northwest of Lake Van.
What's your connection with Lake Van?
What's my connection with Lake Van?
Perfect time for us to take a break. Yes, let's cut it right here. Every week we play a song of the week. It gives us a little bit of chance to catch our breath, to digest some of the things that have been said. And today, well, let's take a little bit of take a little moment right now with Gomidas Vartabed. I think you figured out it wasn't going to be Gomidas Vartabed. Actually, it is music that has been developed off of the creations of Gomidas Vartabed. This is off of an album called Ten Revelations, and it came out several years ago. One of my favorites. I will put a link on today's show notes so you could explore not only the album, but the other creations and the other compositions of the artist. And as I always say, please support the artists that we feature here on The Next Step. They give us so much. They just fill up our lives with the music, the charm. And this one, again, based on the works of Gomidas Vartabed, called The Pavement and the Path. All right, let's continue with our interview with Ani Shaheen. Okay, now what's your connection with Lake Vaughan?
Yes, what's my connection with Lake Vaughan? I actually, when I first started my doctoral thesis, I was working with the genocide martyrs. This was my interest, mm-hmm. because it was important for me to interpret the events of the genocide through a Christian lens. I had spent a long time in Washington seeing this being done from a political lens, and I did not think it was working. This was sort of where I stood in my sort of conviction over, I would say, almost a decade in Washington. So my observation was that there is something more about what happened to the genocide period that needs to be interpreted through the lens of our history, through the lens of the Christian mind understanding. So Of course, my family history goes back to Paulo on my father's father's side, but my father's mother's side goes back to Achtamar and Lake Van. So I knew many stories and sort of what happened to them from my aunt, from my family, sort of stories that I had learned from them. As this is present in the back of my mind, and I can share a bit more of their story in a bit, but when I studied the texts, this is called Hayots Norva Ganej, Hakob Manandian and Hadachia Ajarian, two scholars in the early 20th century, late 19th century. They compiled all these martyrs in Armenian church history. And they identified Norva Ganej because there were some that had not necessarily been celebrated in the Heismavurk, some that had been mentioned in the Heismavurk but had not been canonized. So there, it's a list of lives of the saints that I think really deserves today's attention in terms of what they experienced, because the interpretation and understanding of them perhaps could be a lens for the genocide martyrs. So this was my thinking. So when I sort of did a sort of a categorical study of these martyrs, sort of putting them in their place or where they were, I came across a large collection of martyrdoms in the Lake Van region. And they all came about in the period of 14th, 15th century. So again, we have martyrs later on, but this period was concentrated. So I started looking through the texts and decided that I would focus on this period on Lake Van based on my evidence of what I was finding. Only later to make the connection that that same region was where my ancestors in 1896-7, around that period, were martyred. So the connection for me became personal, but it was interesting to sort of recognize that after the fact, after I had identified a handful of texts, which become essentially my doctoral thesis, to sort of step back and say, oh, interesting. So I'm writing something for 14th, 15th century, but a few hundred years later, my family experienced something very similar. What does this mean? So this is my inspiration, because I don't know if it wasn't for some sort of divine arrangement. Why my life? Why am I here? How did this happen? Sort of, you look at what happened to my family's background, you know, no one survived. Mm-hmm. Only my grandfather survived, 7-8 years old. And then on my grandmother's side, only my great-grandmother survived and her brother. So between these three individuals, now there's this whole tree, family tree. And the question is, why? How did this happen? And of course, we can have all sorts of interpretations that are not necessarily, we can give a biological one. We can give a sort of, you know, a happenstance of some chance, which are not convincing to me. There has to be something more. So this is how I sort of have been thinking about my family history. And then to sort of see this, these texts come together, I thought perhaps if I can understand what happened to the population of that region pre-Ottoman, then perhaps I can have an understanding that can translate into sort of a sequence of events that led to the future events in the region. And I must say that this period, it's again, I take it as a divine sort of directive to find this. It has so many principles for us today, not just sort of what happened during the genocide, but principles for how I live my life today. How do I experience my Christian sort of, understanding and the virtues, especially in my life today? So this is sort of how I understand it from that time period to for me. But then the question is, what does this mean for my community? Right. And that's, I think there is a very nice transition there that I find it inspirational. Actually, there is rich material that I did not know about. It literally took, you know, someone to sort of sit down and sort of investigate.
So can you briefly get into what is it that you found in that area that that resonated? What was the some of the specifics? I know you don't need to get into deep teachings, some things resonated with you. So
I think one of the things that's very rich for that, the teachings of that period, that I find a direct relevance for me today and for my community, is something along the lines of how we look at responsibility and how do we look at the relationship between my responsibility and my freedom. We're very sort of, in our culture, we're very actively advocating for our freedoms, for our, you know, for our voice, for our the very things that we sort of want to engage and sort of express. These are values in our society today. And what I'm finding from this period that helped me sort of make the connection as to how to be free and how to truly be free in that sense is this, the second arm of that conversation, which is responsibility cannot be missing. So if I'm free, that means I'm somehow confined in a way that I can actually be free within those limits. Because if you, for example, if you have a, I think a perfect example in this case is looking at the freedom of a child. If you give them to do anything, they would not know to do what, they will not necessarily have a idea of to do anything because everything isn't necessarily directive enough, especially if you have a young mind. So this is if we sort of translate this into our experience. I think what I find from these texts to be very, very nicely showing our responsibility and the limits in which we are free. So essentially the idea of, for example, the main concept, I would say, is the Armenian term, and I will just sort of use this, Anz Nishkhanutsyun. I speak of this in some of my writings, what it means to be self-governing, and that gives me the ability to be free. Then because I'm in control of my sort of emotions, you know, so through which then I can actually, in my actions, be free. So there is that connection between the will and the action, or the mind and the action. So this is, gets a little bit more philosophical, but I think if I were to take a handful of teachings from this period, I would want to bring forth the richness of what it means to be fully human, as I understand it from these texts, by re-emerging ourselves into the human virtues.
It's very interesting. You're bringing up responsibility, and you look at the time period, you look at the Ottoman invasion coming in. It would have been very easy for them to have thrown that responsibility issue. I mean, this is one of the things that we deal with now when we talk about the genocide. We throw it on others instead of taking the responsibility that we are responsible for our lives. And
that's right.
And it's interesting that that's your takeaway from this period, is that these people spoke about responsibility in a time where it would have been very easy to toss it on somebody else, you know?
Yeah, and we don't, actually, the Vartapets, again, in plural, I refer to the handful that I'm reading from this period. That's very important for them. And actually, a lot of their writings is addressed to the priests who would eventually then teach their congregation. So, again, I see this to be sort of a very important context to understand how, you know, the community develops in the preceding centuries.
Let me just ask a procedural question that I know I'm not the only one who's going to ask. Where are you reading this stuff? I'm sure you don't just open up Amazon and download a Kindle, right? Where are you actually reading these texts?
So the main texts are in the Haismavurk, which I can translate to be Synaxarian, which Synaxarian would be, you know, using the Haismavurk within the church calendar to sort of read the lives of the saints. And these lives of the saints, two versions of them were published by a press in Constantinople in 1729.
Okay.
So there's a printed version of this. I accessed them via my manuscript for my study, and I'm very happy to state that I found a quite early version of it from 1438. So the first compilation is 1401, which hasn't been identified, if still extant, if we still have this we don't know if there is. I mean, the Matanadaran has over 12,000 manuscripts, so but it hasn't been identified in one of those, whether it's in one other part of the world. This is very interesting. So it hasn't been identified, but I was able to find the year from 1438, which I have been using to access the lives of the saints, which we have some of the handful of them that we just spoke about today, but also the writings of Mateos and Khalatetsi. We have them again in manuscript in the Matanadaran, and their commentaries, their colophons, commentaries on the Gospels, where we get a lot of these sort of ways they thought about, and also colophons where they would sort of, at the end of their copying or at the end of their writing of that new manuscript, they would sort of add certain things that was sort of relevant about what was happening around their time. So then they would say, you know, it was during the rule of so-and-so, and in that time period, these events took place, and then they would talk about the events in a very sort of allegorical and sort of metaphorical way, and then sort of insert in information that becomes very useful for historians and scholars. And we use the colophons in scholarship. We use them quite sometimes to recreate or reconstruct times of periods that doesn't exist in any other parts of evidentiary material in histories. For example, the period I write about, we don't have a history for that period. So the colophons become quite important to understand what's happening at that point in Armenia, or even sometimes they will also talk about what's happening around them.
As a scholar, you're looking at Armenia, 14th century, you're bringing in these religious writings, these spiritual writings, and then you take your next step into the 21st century, and you're standing here, and you see the world that really is quite distant from what you're seeing in the 14th century. Distant not only in time, but in ideas. The Christ. I want to talk a little bit about Christ of the 14th century Vartabeds, and the Christ that we're getting given to us. You know, come and read your Bible. If you read the Bible, you will see that Jesus Christ cares about everybody. He's a loving, compassionate Jesus. We have to be tolerant, and you know, this opens the doors to issues of sexuality, of tolerance towards ethnicities and everything, which is a big issue right now. We have so many things, and so all of a sudden the Christ figure that we are being given is being shaped by our world around us, which I'm sure the Christ figure in the 14th century, who is that Christ in the 14th century? How do you process that 14th century Christ coming into the 21st century? A couple weeks ago, we were at a demonstration in Glendale at the City Church, and you know, within their denomination, they've had separation because they've accepted the LGBT community and everything, and they're adamant about saying, well, this is Christian, and the other side is adamant about saying, no, this is not Christianity. And these Vartabeds were way ahead of the game, I think. Their tolerance was, I mean, if they're sitting with Muslims coming in and the Ottoman Empire ready to break our back, you talk about tolerance. So where's that?
So I think the question about Christ, and this is an important question because really everything we believe comes down to who he is, in a sense, right? Because it's Christ. He is the one who sort of brings in the question of Trinity. He is the one who brings in the question of the possibility of a bodily resurrection, the question of something here and after. You know, so much is around the person of Christ. One thing I'm taking away still as I'm reading about the Christ of the, represented in this period, in 14th, 15th century, they seem to really understand the fullness of what Christ is saying about the human person. So often we see very much repetitively in Tathagatsi's writings as well, in the Book of Questions, where he is giving instructions to his students, he would say about the foreigner, who is also made in the image of God. Very different from you, but because they are the image of God, how do you interact with them? And then he'll sort of have instructions on that. And this idea of the image and likeness, I think this is very important that I'm gathering from this period of writing. And this is very traditional to Gregory Usaburich, his teachings. There's this idea of both the image and likeness of God. And I think Christ becomes so real to the people. And when he is that real, then how you treat the other becomes really the question of how do you treat someone who is made in the image of God, in the image and likeness of God. So the application in this period, very useful to my understanding, has been because they have a full... So Christ is not... A lot of the confessions that the martyrs give, it's a confession to Christ. What do they mean by that? So what is this confession that gives the strength to this sort of virtuous figure to stay strong in times of tribulation or in times of difficulties or in times of... The moral story, the moral lesson, I think, is that they've come to understand the fullness of the human being. So they understand the complexities. And because they do, they have this sort of fuller picture of what Christ is doing for them. So he's not just sort of this distant, far away figure who was crucified 2,000 years ago and he resurrected and maybe there is a second coming. You know, so this, it's not that. That's not what I'm experiencing in my texts. This is something where Christ is resurrected and is with them and is alive. And as a matter of fact, and I think in the Armenian church we have this understanding. I was talking to another scholar about this past weekend, this idea of realized eschatology, you know, this idea, which is essentially that Christ is resurrected and with us. It's very important to not minimize the person that you are being either confronted by or the person that you are engaging with, you know. So the other, if you already have that sort of presuppositional, again, getting into it, but the preconception that they are in the image and likeness of God, your interactions become different. Now, it's not important what their confession is. It's not important what position they're in. The most important thing there is where you come from and how you understand the human being and why you understand it that way. And perhaps this is something for further study and sort of contemplation. But my understanding from this period so far is that the Vartapets I read have this understanding. Thereby, they're able to communicate to their audience about who Christ is. He's not just some person that stays in history. He's experiential, historical. I like to say that, you know, he's both historical, but he's also experiential. He's right there. And they are able to take part in that. And that's what we do for communion, right?
Right.
That's what we engage.
Joshua gets sick,
yeah. And eats the light. And I think I love that in our Sharagans. It says, you know, that we are to partake of the light that he is. And then we are illumined. And if you're illumined, how can you see someone else other than? And it's that, and that's what's very important to...
Realized eschatology. I love that.
Yeah, I have a lot of questions about eschatology as the critical person that I am. So I always want to think about what is it? I
mean, realized. It's realized.
It is. It's
what
right
we're
now.
Talking about. Yeah. Thank you. I really appreciate this candid conversation. I want to ask you, Armenian Church, 21st century, what do we have to offer? Do we have anything to offer the world? I mean, yeah, this is great. You've dug out all of this stuff. Is there anybody listening? Do we have a hope that we could offer this to the world? Do we, I mean, or maybe what's the mechanics of offering this to the world?
Right. I think we must bring it to the modern mind. So this is the challenge, that the absence of that Vartapet class, we failed to bring this to the modern mind. And I think we need to do that. And partly what I want to engage in, partly what I want to do for my modern sort of context is, you know, an analogy we discussed earlier. I can repeat it here in a sense that, you know, if you have something that's not working, you go to the expertise who would actually be able to make that work for you. Mm-hmm. So far, I mean, if we have, you know, in our California context, without a car, it's impossible. How do you get from
A
to B?
Right.
If something breaks down, you find the expert and they fix it for you. You don't do it yourself necessarily. You fix that and then you're on your way. I think we have been stuck because our expertise have been sort of either silenced or not present. And I'm looking forward to a period in the near future where we can be the mechanics. You know, the scholarship doesn't just remain in scholarship. It comes to the modern mind to say we can bring the livelihood, the liveliness of these teachings so that the modern person can say, there is something for me here. I'm stuck.
Yeah.
Someone can help me to get from my to my destination. And there are many destinations. There isn't just the ultimate, right? It's a journey.
It's a journey.
And in that journey, we have multiple destinations. And in that various destinations to get there, if you're stuck, this is what the spirit of the church does. You come to it, you get refreshed. It's not just coming in and not understanding the liturgy. This is what's very important. Had I walked into an Armenian church 10 years ago, 8 years ago, I would probably sit there and think, okay, well, this is kind of nice, but doesn't really say anything to me. Mm-hmm. But today I'm walking in and thinking, my goodness, it's sort of a new inspiration and oxygen. So I'm inspired. I take in a new fresh breath of air. Why? Because I understand. So I want to bring that understanding to the modern mind, to the modern person who walks in and sees the church, the miniature paintings or the icons and the beautiful representations and thinks, okay, but this is something from the past. I think I'm convinced to say it's not. And in our confusing modern world, I think it has something to say to us.
But that's your journey. You've journeyed to that point.
That's right.
You didn't just wake up and realize
no,
that.
No, absolutely not. And every day I'm waking up.
Yeah.
So it's not a one-time thing.
Yeah.
So awakening, sort of to be awake and alert. I like to say this about my Vartap. It's also Gregory. So the name Gregory means like alert, awakened in the Greek. And what's very nice about what this period, all of them sort of sign their names, not in the Greek Gregory, but they would say something like Artun. So Gregory, Grigor Khalatetsi, signs his name as Artun. And oftentimes we didn't know that these were his writings because we were expecting to see Grigor Khalatetsi. But no, we see Artun and we're thinking, okay, you know, we're just taking the name, the word, as opposed to a signature. Later on, thanks to scholarship, we've identified these texts to be Gregory of Khalat, Grigor Khalatetsi. We have the same thing about Narekatsi, and my advisor from Oxford, he very well has said this. For example, he signs not Grigor Narekatsi, but Haskor, because he is the sort of the defender or the guardian of these tenets and these truths. So that's sort of, it's a journey, yes, and it's there are multiple stops. But we can't do it on our own. No journey is ever done on a single person's strength. There are people that along the way come and sort of, you know, give you that energy or inspiration or guidance. And especially for the younger generation, I think it's so important to find that through the teachings that we have in our own tradition.
Mm-hmm.
I can learn a lot from, and I think what I appreciate about Mateusz Czuchajewski, he's a phenomenal, phenomenal mind. He sort of is so, he says this one line, he says, you know, it's great, let's learn the richness of all the other teachings and know them, but let's not forsake ours. And really, that's what I want to sort of remind myself. I'm not going to forget all that's being done around me, of course,
right.
But I want to bring this tradition in conversation with everything that's being taught, that's being exercised, that's being, you know, practiced and lived. Let's bring ours also to the table for conversation and for education.
Let me ask you the other side of this question. Yeah, we have this to offer the world. Do we have anything to learn from the world, from
Absolutely.
Other Christian
Absolutely.
Traditions?
Absolutely. And I think that's what Mateusz is really emphasizing, is that there is us. I mean, we must be in conversation.
Mm-hmm.
This is how we exist in sort of our, both in our immediacy, but also in a larger sphere. You know, if you sort of just do it for your own self, you know, then that's really, you know, what is that? But I think there are very much... there some traditions have exercised certain things in a bit more sort of different context, and I think we can sort of reflect on that and see how that teaches us to be more, and I will come back to the word alert, because if we don't want, I mean, to be sort of used to our context, we can sometimes fall asleep. It becomes familiar, it becomes too, so we don't want that. So then in engagement with the other traditions, we remain alert. We say that, oh, this is great, we have this, and then they're in conversation. And how does that sort of bring us more, be relevant for today's culture, but also in tune? So aligned. I like the term alignment, because something that's not aligned does not work. And to bring this these various ideas in alignment is very important.
Well, we get back to your earlier metaphor about the car, right?
Yeah.
You align the car. Right?
Imagine driving a car out of alignment. It's just not going to work. It's not going to work. But the human body, too. I mean, just to say this about... I'm not sure who the Vatapet is telling this analogy. I think it's it's from the Church Fathers, perhaps, from maybe Chrysostom, or even one of the Gregories from the Cappadocian Fathers. They sort of bring the human body and the city, and they sort of marry them to show how the various functions of the human body are the various functions of the city. And if either one of them are out of line, they don't necessarily work. So for example, you know, you have they say that the governing the king is the mind, so for example, you know, so if there is no sort of governance, then, and if there is no mind, then the rest of them is misaligned or doesn't necessarily, you know, work in accordance. So these are very important. Again, one of the lessons would be, how can we bring this to our modern conversation?
You give chiropractic a nice little plug there.
That's right. That's right. I mean,
we're looking at religious chiropractic or spiritual chiropractic.
Try to go for a nice long run while you're, you know, out of alignment.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Going to cause other problems. So I think that's important to be aware of.
Ani, thank you so much for taking the time being with us. I hope that this can be an ongoing conversation and we can do everything. But I want to wish you all the best in your endeavors and God's blessings be with you. Really, really appreciate you taking the time and doing it, and fascinating. Please keep us informed of your progress. We'd love to share that with our listeners as well.
Thank you, Father Vasquez. And just a quick word of encouragement to all out there who are seeking and searching and trying to find some sort of, you know, encouragement in their journey. It's out there. So I would say all of the people who are seeking, continue seeking, askers, keep asking, and those who actually go through those doors will be open to them.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview. I certainly did. Gave us so much to think about. And as I said, I hope that this will just open the door for further conversations with a brilliant mind and a up-and-coming voice, articulate voice, for the Armenian Church. Well, you know what? We transitioned without that piano, and here it is. Yeah, it just wouldn't work inside that beautiful cathedral, but it works for us right now. Here's Susie with her message.
Before getting back to the next step with Father Vazgen, I'd like to take this opportunity to remind you that this ministry is supported through the heartfelt donations of listeners like you. Thanks for keeping us in your prayers and partnering with this expanding and dynamic outreach. The next step is entering homes and communities with a solid message proclaiming God's message of love, forgiveness, and compassion. We look forward to your comments and words of encouragement. Please consider partnering in this dynamic ministry by making a contribution. By pressing on the donate button on our website, you can set up automatic donations either weekly, monthly, or annually. Your donation goes a long way in furthering this ministry. Even more, tell your friends and family by sharing the Next Step link or website with them. We're on iTunes and Blueberry, as well as Facebook and Twitter. We are excited about this ministry and invite you to share in our enthusiasm. This is Susie wishing you all of God's blessings in your life. We now return to the Next Step with Father Vazgen.
Thank you, Susie, for that announcement, and thank you, all of you, for all of the love, the support, the beautiful messages you send me, the emails. Everything gets read, even if I can't answer you back immediately. I do read them, and especially your prayer requests. Know that those prayers, I remember each and every one of you, especially when I celebrate the Divine Liturgy before the Holy Altar in our Armenian Church. And thank you for your prayers for this ministry. It really keeps us going. This Sunday, I'll be out in Thousand Oaks. If you happen to be in that area, would love to see you. Let's see, Saturday, actually, be out in Rancho Mirage. Next week, we have the Deacons Training Program out by the Sequoias. I'm going to be out there on Wednesday training these young men for service. I mean, it is a lot of stuff happening, and thank God for air conditioning, because it is so hot, miserably hot. And I think the guy who invented air conditioning, I just really hope that there is a spot for him in heaven, a special spot for him in heaven. Man, I don't know. If you know what hot and humid is, that's what we've got over here. But nevertheless, we are together, we share together, and our joys and our difficulties are ones that we engage in, all for the glory of God. And that's what we need to really, really be focused in on. Whatever we do it with a smile on our face. Hey, listen, I would love to hear from you. If you want to drop me a line, you can find me at feedback@epostle.net. Epostle, that's apostle with an E. Apostolic Evangelism for an Electronic and Expanding Universe. Oh, it doesn't get any better. Listen, I want to thank you for joining us. I hope you enjoyed today's show as much as we enjoyed producing it. On behalf of our producer, Susie, and myself, Father Voskin, we look forward to seeing you again next week when we will take the next step.
And now here's the fine print.
The information and comments presented within this podcast and our website do not necessarily represent the views of the Armenian Church hierarchy, but are presented as a challenge to define the dynamics of Armenian Orthodoxy in all aspects of life. Listening to these shows is habit-forming. Addictive behavior associated with the next step is rarely, if ever, remedied. Rather, the next step is known to relieve and cure common cases of narrow-mindedness, prejudice, numbskulledness, and glaucoma in patients over the age of 20. Results may vary depending on credit rating. Findings are based on double-blind studies conducted in Istanbul and Jerusalem. Side effects include mind expansion, clarity of focus, higher rates of heart palpitations, sensitivity to the pain of others, and occasional nausea. The management and production crew of epostle.net take full responsibility for changes you will experience. Not valid with any other offer.
Take your breath cut out!
I want to ask you if you're seeing the same sky as we are.
Off by one top minutes!